It's a great pleasure to introduce Guillaume Balle. He is professor at Columbia. And again, I will only extract one item from his long list of accomplishments. He has, about a month ago, won the Calderon Prize, which is given by the Inverse Problems Society for the most distinguished person in inverse problems under the age of 40 in the world. And Guillaume.
Okay, thank you very much, Adrian, for the invitation. Thank you all for being here. So this is this talk is on inverse problem and very related to what we heard from Li Hong, in the sense that we want to combine high resolution with high contrast. And the technology that Li Hong presented to us, photoacoustic, is one way to do so. And once we have done the experiments, there's still some work to do mathematically. Li Hong presented some algorithms to image what we're interested in. When we want to quantify the tissue properties, we have to do an additional step, which is an inverse problem with internal data, with internal functionals. And this is this class of inverse problems that I'm interested in today. So before we go into the inverse problems with internal functionals, let's remind ourselves of the prototypical example of a mathematical problem in medical imaging and in imaging in general, which is the Calderon problem. So this is an equation here, an elliptic equation with a parameter gamma, which is the parameter that we'd like to reconstruct. It might have some tell you some properties of tissues, electrical properties, scattering properties, like what we saw in Li Hong's talk. And we can probe our medium from the outside. So G is always going to refer to some type of illumination in this talk. We can probe the medium from the outside. And we make some measurements. Measurements here are going to be measurements of currents. And the Calderon problem is this. Let's assume that we illuminate our domain from all possible angles at every possible point. Let's assume that we measure the current coming out of this domain. Is this data, which is referred to as the Cauchy data, enough to reconstruct gamma? That's the Calderon problem. And there's a long history of that problem. It was solved in a linearized version by Calderon himself in 1980. Then there was this breakthrough by Sylvester and Ullmann in 87, breakthrough by Adrian Nachman in 88, breakthrough by Stella and Pararinta in 06, that essentially told us that, yes, we can solve that problem. If you give me two sets of data that are the same than the gamma, if you give me two sets of data for and injectivities, if you give me two sets of data that are equal, then gamma, I get it right. Finally, gamma, the two gammas have to be equal. Okay, so in that sense, the problem mathematically is well defined. However, there is a huge difficulty with that problem, which is that the modulus of continuity of this inverse map is not to our liking. Essentially, what we see in that problem is that we have a severe loss of resolution because the reconstruction has a logarithmic stability. What this roughly means is that if you give me data with 10 to the negative 10 accuracy, which is very hard to get, the accuracy that you will get on the reconstruction is 1 over 10. Okay, 10 to the 10 being almost impossible, 10 to the negative 10 accuracy being almost impossible to get. In practice, we observe that the resolution that we can obtain in such cases is very, very low. All right, so that's the same problem in electrical impedance tomography and in optical tomography. That's what Li Hong presented to us earlier today. So why do we care, nonetheless, about those technologies, electrical impedance tomography and optical tomography? We care about them because they give us very high contrast. They tell us whether tissues are healthy or not with a relatively good accuracy. And so that's something that we want to consider very seriously, take to our advantage. However, they come with low resolution. Is there a way that we can still maintain the high contrast while at the same time having a high resolution? And this is the paradigm of these new hybrid medical imaging techniques that have been introduced over the past 10 years, that we try to combine a technique with high contrast with another technique with high resolution. Where do we get high resolution? Well, you saw one example in the previous talk. Ultrasound is one way to get high resolution. There are other techniques, MRI, X-ray, CT. These techniques, as standalone techniques, sometimes have high contrast, but sometimes they have low contrast. The sound speed between healthy and non-healthy tissues, for instance, it doesn't vary very much. Sound speed between these two things is very similar. So you don't have high contrast for tissues, whereas you can have very high contrast optically. So hybrid inverse problems essentially ask the physics to come to the rescue and give us some physical coupling. That's the important bullet point here in this sentence. There's a physical coupling between a high contrast modality and a high resolution modality. Okay, so again, ultrasound is high contrast will come from optics and high resolution will come from ultrasound. And there's a physical coupling, which I will reiterate, there's a physical coupling which couples with optics with ultrasound. As optics penetrates to tissues, they heat up tissues and they generate ultrasound. This coupling is where physics helps us. Okay, so in this lecture, I really would like to focus on ultrasound being the high resolution modality. Briefly touch upon MRI. And again, the high contrast comes from mostly optical properties or electrical properties, but also elastic properties. Those are the main examples that I will have in mind while making the presentation. So now, once we've said this, typically these hybrid inverse problems come in two steps. And the first step is what you heard about during the first talk. And the second step is what you didn't hear about, and that's really what I will focus on. So what is that first step? That first step is there's been a coupling between these two physical modalities. We have acquired data, which again for photoacoustic are ultrasound data. The first thing we do is take those ultrasound data, backpropagate them into the medium and get something. That something is what Li Hong presented to us. That's something I will consider as the first step. And you will see that that first step gives us an internal functional of what we're interested in. It does not quite give us what we're interested in. So the second step, which is mathematically what I want to focus upon, let's assume that now we have an equation and we have internal functionals that are functionals of what we're interested in, functionals of the solution of the equation, typically. So we don't necessarily know the solution of the equation because we don't know the parameters yet. Let's assume that we have this type of functionals. What can we do with them? What are the parameters that we can uniquely determine? What is the stability that's related to resolution? Hopefully the stability will have greatly improved compared to what we had in the Calderon problem. And more important, also equally importantly, under which illumination do we have the results that we want? How do we need to probe the objects of interest in order to get this unique determination or this stability? And you will see that the illuminations that we choose matter a lot, and it's not easy mathematically to characterize what are those illuminations that make the whole mechanism work. I guess I'll spend some time on that. So now let me go to some questions, and I'll mostly talk about diffusion equations or diffusive-like equations, elliptic equations. So let's assume that quite generally we have an elliptic problem with U the solution, which could be the potential in EIT, or which could be the density of photons in optical tomography. And let's look at the parameters that we don't know. There's a scattering parameter, a diffusion coefficient gamma, and there's an absorption parameter sigma. Again, we can probe the domain from the outside. So G is going to be the illumination. It's how you send photons into your tissues. And here is the internal functional. So that's what Li Hong presented to us. The images that we saw in the previous talk were images of a very similar type to what I'm describing here. That was H of X, where X is two or three dimensional, or even four dimensional if you have a movie. But let's say X here is three dimensional, and here is the functional that you have access to. So in photoacoustics, it's a functional that involves the solution U of the problem that you don't know. It's how many photons made it at some place that has some effect. then some of these photons are absorbed. Okay, so sigma times A tells you a number of photons being absorbed as a function of space. And then gamma is a coupling parameter. That's this physical coupling that I was referring to. That's the coefficient that tells you when photons are absorbed, how much acoustic signal is being emitted. Okay, gamma is the coupling between the absorbed photons and the emitted ultrasonic signal. Okay, so let's assume that at the end of the first step, we have access to this internal functional. What can we reconstruct? So here's the player. Here's what you can play with now. You can play with G. You can send photons from various illuminations. So you have let's say you have J, which is the number of experiments you're making. You want it as small as possible to save time. But J is the number of illuminations that and physical experiments that you're making. Now let's assume that for each of these GJ, you have access to an HJ. So you have these informations. Now, what can you reconstruct on gamma, sigma, and big gamma? Little gamma, big, little sigma, and big gamma, all of this. How stable are the reconstructions? And how do we choose the illuminations? Okay, so that's what we have in the context of quantitative photoacoustic. In magnetic resonance elastography, where gamma now is going to be a Lamé parameter in an elastic equation of elasticity, which has been scalarized, obviously, and the ultrasound is being replaced by MR. Mathematically, the prime is roughly the same. Instead of having gamma sigma here, you just said gamma sigma is 1. What you measure is just U, and from measurement of U, which are elastic displacements, what can we reconstruct on the Lamé parameter? Okay, so there are a lot of problems that are very similar from a mathematical point of view. Okay, so let me stick to photoacoustic. I don't think Li Hong showed this one. This is the, again, to remind ourselves of the coupling that we have in this setting. We send radiation into tissues. The radiation is a pulse. It propagates very quickly through tissues. Some photons are absorbed, and because they absorb, the temperature heats up a little bit. Because the temperature heats up a little bit, the tissues expand mechanically. Because the tissues expand mechanically, they generate sounds. You are there outside listening to that sound. Okay, so the first thing you do when you have sound measurements, you time reverse them and back propagate them to see where they came from. The wave equation is a unitary operator. So if you want to do the inverse, just take the adjoint and you will get back propagation. If you do this, this is what you get. And these are the pictures that Li Hong showed us. Okay, so the internal functional that you get from this first step is this. That can be very difficult, and Günther Ulmad will make a presentation tomorrow on that very first step when there are some complications, when the sound speed is not constant, and when sound does not propagate in a constant medium, then of course the inversion is much more complicated. So that first step is not necessarily easy. Here in this talk, I will assume it is done. Okay, and we are focusing on the next step, which is quantitative reconstructions. Okay, so quantitative reconstructions. We want to reconstruct coefficients from this type of internal functionals. And I'll give you some other examples of equations and physical phenomena as we go. All right, so here are some references on PAT and QPAT. So you've just heard Li Hong talk about photoacoustic in general. This has exploded in the biomedical engineering community in the past 10 years. It also in the mathematical literature, we see a lot of efforts being done to do some reconstruction, generate some new reconstruction algorithms, fast reconstruction algorithms. So you see a lot of names that may sound look familiar to you if you come from the theoretical inverse problems community. Okay, so here is another model that I'd like to mention briefly, which is now a Helmholtz equation instead of, another elliptic equation instead of the EIT tap model. This is what happens in quantitative thermoacoustics. What you send into tissues now are not high frequency photons, but low frequency radiation, microwaves with 3 meters of wavelength, something like this. And as those waves propagate, they also get absorbed. And that's modeled by this conductivity coefficient here. This is an absorption coefficient for Maxwell's equations, okay? It's a scalarized version of Maxwell's equation, and this tells you how the waves get absorbed. And as the waves, the amount of ultrasound generated is proportional to the energy that is being absorbed. And here's the energy that is being absorbed. So again, let's assume that we have access to this internal functional sigma times modulus of u squared in an equation of this type. Can we reconstruct sigma from knowledge of h? Okay, so you see that you've lost the phase in this information, but you have internal measurements. So this is a second problem of the hybrid inverse prime class. There's a different mechanism that we can use to couple ultrasound and optics, which is ultrasound modulation. So and Li Hong also mentioned it in his presentation in a different flavor from what I'm going to talk about here. But what we can do to couple ultrasound and optics is to send ultrasonic signals into tissues. When you have an ultrasound propagating through tissues, the tissues vibrate. Because the tissues vibrate, their properties change a little bit. The scatterers and the absorbers get compressed and dilated. They change their properties as scatterers and absorbers. So when you do the experiment with and without this ultrasound, you're essentially propagating photons in slightly different media. You take the difference of these two measurements, with and without the ultrasound present. You take the difference, do a little bit of manipulations, an inverse Fourier transform a la MRI, if you know this modality. And what you get out of this in the model that we've done with John, published last year, what you get out of this for this problem here, again, where the diffusion coefficient and the absorption coefficient are the parameters of interest, what you get as an internal functional is something that's now more complicated. It's quadratic in the gradient of u for some component of it, and it's quadratic in u for another component of it. So this is yet another internal functional that we can obtain from very reasonable physical experiments, which gives us something, again, proportional to grad u squared. That's the big term that is very difficult to deal with from a mathematical point of view. Okay, so another internal functional, another hybrid inverse problem for us to play with. And again, the difficulty here is reconstruct sigma and gamma, but also find the illuminations that are appropriate for the reconstructions. How do we probe the domain in order to efficiently reconstruct sigma and gamma? That's something that's difficult. So ultrasound modulation, here's a cartoon. You send some of this ultrasound that will change the properties of a medium here, and you have optical signals coming from the left. And you see how this optical field is altered by this ultrasound, which we can assume is at one point. It's very dangerous because ultrasound are never stopping at one point. But okay, you have to assume how the medium is modified. You see that as the medium is modified, certainly your signal is altered, and you want to use this alteration to get information, okay? There's a lot of modeling to do at that stage, still at the level of modeling. One possible modeling is what we did with John that gives us this internal functional. Again, if you do different modelings, you might get very different internal functional. Depends on the regimes of physics. Okay, so here again are some references on this problem, just to maybe mention a few. There's this paper by Amari, Eric Bontier, who is here, Matthias Fink, who is here, that somehow started this type of measurements with grad u squared appearing. There's a very nice paper by Capdebos, Fehrenbach, Frédéric de Gournay, who is here, and Ottavian Cavillon, that solved this problem in a two-dimensional setting. And I'll talk a little bit about what we've done with Eric. François Monard is a student with me, Fuzzy Tricky, and then with François also. Some of the reconstructions that we propose for this problem. You will see that mathematically it's not completely trivial to do these reconstructions. All right, so here's a roadmap of what we do. We forget about step one. We really assume that we have an equation which will always be an elliptic equation here. It could be a transport equation. We have very few results on that. I'll stick to elliptic models for this talk. Let's assume we have an elliptic model. Let's assume we have internal information. What do we do with this? When there are several unknowns, the first thing you do is to eliminate as many as possible to get an equation for one of them. This is obviously standard, but sometimes this is an easy elimination. And for some problems, it turns out that the elimination is not easy at all. Now, here's a property which is interesting. Once you have done the eliminations, then there's a big if that appears. If for some reason the elliptic solution, the solution to the elliptic equation satisfies some nice properties, then you can do everything. And you get unique and stable reconstructions. There's a big if. But the if is there, and the if depends on the illumination. Okay, so I come back to this notion of illumination. How you probe your medium is going to matter. If you probe the medium well, then your solution will have no critical points. If you have no critical point, you will be able to do something with it. It's very difficult to know whether solutions of elliptic equations do not have critical points. There's a lot of regularity theory that tells you that the solutions are smooth when this and this is satisfied. However, that there's no critical point, gradient U is not zero. That's something that's very hard to verify. Okay, so I'll present a method to you that's based on complex geometric optic solutions, which is also what Calderon used to solve his problem, and after that, Günther Ullmann and Sylvester and all the people who worked on the Calderon problem. The complex geometric optic solutions are used there, and they are also used in hybrid inverse problems for that reason, that solutions have to have satisfy some properties in order to, for the solutions to be stable, the reconstructions to be stable. Okay, and CGOs are the only way that we can prove this. Okay, so mathematically, there's something interesting here. QPAT. So QPAT is quantitative photoacoustic with two or more measurements. So let's remind ourselves that the problem is this. We have gamma and sigma that are not known, and we have internal functionals of this form. U is the solution of the equation, sigma is the absorption, gamma is the Grünheisen coefficient, again, it's the coupling between radiation and ultrasound. Okay, so here's the theory. Let's assume that we make two measurements, that we have two eliminations that are well chosen. I'll come back to that. Let's assume that we have two eliminations that are well chosen. Let's assume that we make those corresponding to internal measurements. Okay, these are indirect measurements. We don't stick probe into the medium. We get these functionals from solving the first inverse problem, the first step of the hybrid inverse problem. Now define this field, H1 squared gradient H2 over H1. This is a vector field that depends on the data. If that vector field is bounded from below, does not vanish, if that vector field does not vanish, then we have a result which says that is the first negative result, which says that those two measurements that we've acquired actually give us everything we can know about all possible measurements acquired from all possible eliminations. So those two eliminations, if they are well chosen, they give us information. You can come back with more experiments, more Gs, more eliminations. The information you will acquire from that is not going to be new. I already know everything you can predict. Okay, so if I know H1 and H2, I know the whole measurement operator from any boundary condition to any internal measurements, internal functional. Okay? So that's negative. There's three coefficients that we want to reconstruct. There's only two linearly independent conditions here. So what can we reconstruct? Well, it turns out that what we can reconstruct is this guy here, this functional of the coefficients we don't know, and that Q, which is yet another functional of the coefficients. And that's it. Once we know Q and chi and Q, we can reconstruct those coefficients, so that closes the loop. Start with two coefficients, you can get them all. That defines what those two parameters are. And once you know those parameters, you can get back to your measurements. Okay? So two well-chosen measurements suffice to reconstruct chi and Q, and thus what we're interested in, up to some transformation leaving chi and Q invariant. So if you come with the photoacoustic setting, you do as many experiments as Li Hong presented to us, and if this physics is correct, you cannot reconstruct the three parameters out of these informations. Even if they are internal measurements, that's not enough to do this reconstruction. So here, what's the proof of that very briefly? Well, you take the equation for U1, you multiply by U2, you take the equation for U2, multiply by U1, subtract, shake, that's what you get. Okay, so that's the elimination part. We have to eliminate unknowns. Here it's relatively simple how you do this. You get an equation for chi which involves that vector field that I've just mentioned. Okay, so that's why we need that vector field to be not too bad. What is this? Now, it's a transport equation for chi. We have a vector field that we know is well behaved. We have a transport equation for chi. We assume that chi is known at the boundary. We reconstruct chi uniquely. Okay? And once you have chi, you can reconstruct q. And once you have q, you can prove that all possible measurements are determined by those two functionals. Okay? So here's the if. The if implies that the vector field is to our liking. Okay? So you see that this is h2 over h1 is really nothing but u2 over u1 by linearity. And you can find a linear elliptic equation for u2 over u1. So this statement is nothing but a statement on critical points of elliptic solutions. That statement of the vector field is just saying, I have an elliptic equation, I want to make sure that there's no critical point of my solution. Again, that's something that comes throughout hybrid inverse problems, and Adrian Nachman has faced similar problems in CDII. Okay, so there's a corollary to that result that I've mentioned, which is that when one coefficient is known, then we can reconstruct the other two. So if the Greenhausen coefficient is known and constant, which is typically what is assumed in practice, then this is the positive result. If we know the Greenhausen coefficient gamma, then we can reconstruct sigma and Lille gamma from this measurement. So that's the positive aspect of quantitative path. Okay. Another aspect, which comes back to resolution, if the if is there, if the critical points are, if there's no critical point in your vector field, or if you're in your elliptic solution, then not only do you have a unique reconstruction, but you have a stable reconstruction. So there are, if you look at the equations that I've mentioned, you shake them a little bit, what you get is that if you give me data h and data h tilde and you make an error in those data, which is relatively small, then the error in the reconstruction between chi and chi tilde is also going to be small. And that's related to resolution. Okay, so if you have good stability properties, small errors translate into small errors, that's a good indication that you can attain resolution. Resolution and stability estimates are not quite one-to-one, but if you have a bad resolution, a bad stability estimate, that often translates into a bad resolution. Okay, so we've achieved our goal here, that we obtain some good resolution properties by quantitative path. So photoacoustic, as we saw, is obviously a good technique. We saw great pictures, so it has to work. From the mathematical point of view, even if you want to do quantitative path, these results tell you that you should be able to extract the information you want. Okay, is the absorption one absorbing event per millimeter or 1.5 absorbing event per millimeter? You will be able to get that 1 or 1.5 out of these reconstructions. So here's just an example of a jagged. Hope you can see the contrast. This is not nearly as impressive as Li Hong's, but okay, since we have access to this. So you can see that if you have a diffusion coefficient, which is jagged, that's the idea, it varies quite a bit. Absorption coefficient, same thing. These are reconstructions in the absence of noise, and these are reconstructions in the presence of noise. You can see that it works quite well, okay, as the theory predicts. Okay, I won't do it again. All right, so what happens for QTAT, the other problem that I mentioned, we have a similar result. So if you have a Helmholtz equation, you don't know what the conductivity is. If you have access to these measurements, this is also something that Li Hong had a very nice paper on several years back. So there's a theoretical result which tells you that if you make errors on H, you get errors on the reconstruction of sigma, which are comparable. This is an effect of diffraction, right? If sigma is very small and you send a plane wave, then u squared is 1. So of course h gives you sigma, okay? So if sigma is very small, you really expect those data to be nice. They almost give you sigma. However, when sigma is large, then you can have some diffraction effects and you have to counteract on this diffraction effect. And that's exactly what this picture says. This is the sigma that we start from. This is h. So if you do nothing, if you just plot h, if you just plot the internal functional that you have access to, this is what you get. Okay, that's the one with contrast. The other ones all look like this. Okay, so if now you go from this measurement and look at an iterative algorithm, that we've implemented, what you get back is the true sigma. Okay, so you can counter effect the influence of the diffraction here. Okay, so that's what the math says for those two problems. Let me finish with the third problem, which is now internal functionals, which involve the gradient of u. Okay, and for might as well make the square here. So the square doesn't matter so much. You can always take the square root of everything. What's important is that you have something that's proportional to the gradient of u here, and you have to deal with the how the coefficient also enters into your equation. So we've simplified the equation tremendously here. I'm just assuming that there's only one coefficient, gamma, that I don't know. We don't really know what to do in this too. Okay, it's an open problem for us to do the reconstruction when both gamma and sigma are not known. So we assume that we have a conductivity here that is not known, and we have access to measurements or internal functionals of this type. Okay, that's what ultrasound modulation gives us. Now, here there's an elimination of gamma. There's two unknowns, there's gamma and u. There's an elimination, which is relatively straightforward, which is to say, okay, gamma is just h over grad u squared. And let's replace gamma by h over grad u squared. We get an equation for u, we're done. The problem, you can do that for sure. The problem is that the nonlinear equation that you get out of this is not so nice and not so nicely behaved. It's what has been dubbed the zero Laplacian. If you look at this problem where grad u, 1 over grad u squared is replaced 1 over grad u to the 2 minus p, so our problem corresponds to p is equal to 0. When p is greater than 1, you have a nice nonlinear elliptic problem with a convex functional, which is given here. Okay, with p is greater than 1, this is indeed convex. There's no problem of theoretical results. You can solve that nonlinear equation with no difficulty. When p is equal to 1, you start having difficulties. Okay, that's the results of Adrian Nachman, Alexandru Tamasan, and Alex Timonov. They've done some very nice work on CDII. These are measurements where the 2 is replaced by 1 here. This elliptic equation becomes degenerate. Now, if you push across the degeneracy, and if p greater than 1 is elliptic, if p is 1 is degenerate, well, p less than 1 is very likely going to be hyperbolic. And sure enough, the problem here with p is equal to 0, as we have in ultrasound modulation, is not elliptic as you might have thought just looking at that guy, but it's actually a hyperbolic equation. So hyperbolic equations, we need Cauchy data. Cauchy data means we need Dirichlet conditions, but we also need Neumann conditions. So let's assume, which we do in practice anyway, that we have access to this Dirichlet and Neumann data. What can we do with that? Well, it turns out that we can do things, but we cannot do all we want. We can have stable reconstructions, but we cannot have stable reconstructions over the whole domain. So when you shake the equation a little bit, you can recast it as follows. This is the equation that we end up with. This is a wave equation, but it's a nonlinear wave equation. Okay, it's quasi-linear. The nonlinearities depend on the gradient of u. So this is an equation which has all the flavors of the wave equation, except that the direction of time. Okay, let's look at the metric here. I'll be a little more explicit here. The direction of time is here is the solution. The direction of time is the direction of grad u, which is the solution of your problem you don't know. So think of a wave equation with the direction of time, which would be the direction of grad u. Okay, you have n dimensions. Grad u is one dimension that we say is time, and everything orthogonal to grad u, you say, is space. Okay, so you go from an n-dimensional problem to one dimension of time, n minus one dimensions of space. That's what this metric says. So there's a direction of time, which we don't know where it is, because it depends on the solution of your equation. Now, we know from the theory of wave equations is that we are going to have stable Cauchy data. We are going to have stable reconstructions, stable solutions of the equation if the Cauchy data are given on space-like parts of the surface, not on time-like part of the surface. When you have a wave equation, you give conditions at t0, and you give p at 0 and dtp at 0. If you had a wave equation in three dimensions and you gave conditions at x is equal to 0, you would not be able to solve your equation in three dimensions. Okay, that's the idea. So here we have some difficulties, and to make it this presentation short, what this says is that we have a reconstruction of what we're interested in, which is gamma, which is stable, but only on a small part of the domain. Well, not necessarily that small, but on a subset of the domain. And what is that subset of the domain? It's relatively difficult to explain it. But essentially, that's the domain which is influenced by boundary conditions, Cauchy data, which are space-like. Okay, so let me give you a picture. Can you see the right picture? So this is a sphere. Let's assume we're... Okay, I think I got it. So this is the sphere is your domain. It's a three-dimensional domain. Now let's assume that you have conditions, boundary conditions, at the boundary of the domain that make that the direction of time is the z-axis. Now when the direction of time is the z-axis, the light cone is given by this blue guy here. What the result says, the previous result says, is that if you are in this setting, you don't know what the metric is. So you don't know that the direction of time is the z-axis. If for some reason the direction of time is the z-axis everywhere inside the domain, then you will get stable reconstructions in that shaded green area, and that's it. As soon as the shaded green area moves close to the light cone, you lose stability. Okay, that's what the theta says here. Theta is essentially a distance between the green and the blue areas, the boundary of the blue area. So we're in this strange situation that even though we have internal data, and we have quite a bit of it, we cannot reconstruct everything. There's something that comes in the way. So let me briefly mention what it is we can do. If you take one measurement, which was, okay, J was equal to 1 in my previous case. J was equal to 1. I had grad U1 was equal to grad U was equal to, okay, so this measurement was grad U squared. Show you again. So the measurement was grad U squared multiplied by gamma. I had just one illumination. Now let's assume that I'm rich enough that I can look at, get this data for a lot of illuminations. And then by polarization or by other tricks, what I measure is not grad U squared anymore, but grad U1 dot grad U2, grad U1 dot grad U3, and so on and so forth. Okay? So I have now redundant measurements. I used to start with one coefficient gamma, which I didn't know, and I had one internal functional H. Now, I saw that I could have some difficulties with that problem, and so I acquire redundant, very redundant measurements of this form. What can I do with this? So once you start with this game, you can mathematically replace gamma by gamma to the 2 alpha. So the problem that I've mentioned to you corresponds to alpha is equal to 1. The problem CDII that Adrian has worked on recently corresponds to alpha is equal to 1. So Adrian, again, works with one measurement. For some reason, they run into some snag. They can then acquire more of those measurements, cranking J to a sufficiently high value. And then the theory that I'm presenting here for does not depend on alpha. It works for alpha is 1 half, alpha is 1, and alpha is everything else. If for some reason, that's physical. But alpha is 1 half is the physics that I talked about. Alpha is 1 is the physics that you have in CDII. Now you have a lot of measurements, and you have a lot of unknowns. The elimination is the hard problem. The elimination in the previous case was trivial. The elimination here is the hard problem. So the way we do it, and that's an idea that we had in the paper by Cap de Bosque, Frédéric de Gournay, and collaborators, the idea here is that this equation, you recast introducing these vector fields S. So S is the gradient of U multiplied by gamma to the 1 half when alpha is 1 half. And what you do is you shake the equations here to write an equation for the divergence of sigma. You see that the divergence of sigma is not very far. Gamma is nothing but square root of gamma times square root of gamma. So you have an equation for the divergence of sigma that comes from here. And then S divided by gamma to the alpha is a gradient. So its curl will vanish. Okay, so the curl of S will satisfy an equation. Okay, and so once you have those equations, Again, the idea is how do we check this until we eliminate f, and that's not so easy, but we can do so. And once we have eliminated f, we find f as a function of s. Now you have another function of s here. S ds is equal to a function of s. And when you know this symmetric part on s and this anti-symmetric part on s, turns out that you can reconstruct s. Okay, that's the idea. So that's something that we've implemented in the paper with Eric Bontier, François Monard, and Fauzi Tricky, and there's some more in the recent paper with François Monard. The idea is that f is that specific functional of s. Okay, so it's essentially Riemannian geometry, soft Riemannian geometry, but nonetheless, you have to look at it from this point of view to get tractable reconstruction algorithms. And then out of this, you get a very stable reconstruction. So gamma, which is the coefficient that you don't know, is stably can be stably reconstructed from errors in measurements and errors at various points. Okay, so you get the stability that you wanted for that problem. So here we need redundant measurements to get away. Let me just say that there's an if here, and that if is that the determinant of several gradients of solutions be non-zero. So you have to construct elliptic solutions so that the gradients make a base. They make a base, okay? And so, do you have 1 minute to minus 1 minute? Okay. All these ifs that I've talked about, there was one if which was we don't want critical points. We don't want solutions, the gradients of solutions to vanish. Another if is we don't want that determinant here to vanish. What we do for this is to use complex geometric optics solutions. So in all these problems that I've mentioned to you, the stability results that we have are conditioned on the solutions having some stability properties. And we use complex geometric optics solutions for that. Okay, so I don't have the time to go through this, but briefly, let me still say that the idea is this. CGO solutions are based on this. You have e to the rho dot x is a harmonic solution when rho is a complex valued object, so that rho dot rho is equal to zero. So let's assume that you are in the perfect setting where you have coefficients that are equal to one or zero. If the conductivity is not known, set it to one. If the absorption is not known, set it to zero. So that you start from a setting which is the setting of harmonic solutions. Now, let's assume you want a property on, say, a vector field. Well, just look at the property of that vector field for those CGOs, for those specific solutions, harmonic solutions. And if you are in this setting, then the vector field can be constructed as just a constant vector field. It's as good as it gets. And now what you do is you come back to your problem and you see, okay, my problem is slightly perturbed. I didn't have an elliptic solution. I had a perturbed elliptic solution. And the idea of CGOs is to somehow show that that perturbation is indeed a perturbation. The qualitative properties that you had in the elliptic setting are preserved when you perturb the equation. Okay, so that's the idea of CGOs as they were used in the Calderon problem. We use them again here to obtain qualitative statements on our solutions. So let me briefly wrap this up by saying that many hybrid imaging modalities do what they are supposed to do. They, at least in from the mathematical point of view, they give us the stability that we want, which is related to high resolution. Very often, they also come with explicit algorithms. By shaking the equations enough, we can get some reconstructions that are relatively easy to implement. And you might have seen that they involve solving linear and nonlinear equations of classical types, transport elliptic hyperbolic equations. The main difficulty from the mathematical point of view is that we need to make sure that the illumination satisfies some conditions. And we use complex geometric optics technologies to construct such solutions, such illuminations. And that's not completely satisfactory. It gives us some constraints that are relatively implicit on how we should construct those illuminations. And that's where there's some very interesting mathematics to do in the future. I will stop on that. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, so Li Hong's question is on optimizations, practical optimizations, depending on the setting you're interested in. So this is actually yeah, a very interesting point. The CGO solutions that we have constructed, what we had in mind was proving a stability estimate. So that was our optimum, if you wish. In order to prove that we have a stability result, we need to make sure that the solution satisfies certain constraints. Now, from the practical point of view, you would like to acquire reconstructions with a stability which is obtained with as little power as possible. All these optimizations have not been done. I'm not sure that the theory of inverse primes is going to be very useful there. There are other mathematical tools in optimization that are probably more appropriate, more adapted to this. But that's a fair point. The type of qualitative and quantitative constraints that we will have on our eliminations will very much depend on the objective that we have. I looked at the objective of stability estimates, but yeah, that's not the most practical one.
Thank you.